It's interesting, even though Hanukkah kind of on the calendar year is sort of a Rabbanan, it is Rabbanan, it's even less than Megillah, which is sort of straddles the Tkufas of Nevi'im and after Nevi'im. Hanukkah is solidly in the camp of modern holidays. It's sort of way after the time we expect that in Nisim, and still you have it. It's, I think for us though, it's a lot more significant because it's the only day, it's the only Yontif that was really the struggle of Klal Yisrael with what's modern. I mean, idol worship is out. Nobody struggles with it, and that's gone. Paros and all sorts of things. We have enemies. But those are things that we don't really struggle with. Hanukkah is the beginning of a modern era. It's the Greece culture. Greek culture is really the background for much that's positive today, and we grapple with it, and that's why there's some meaningful points about it. I want to discuss a certain nekuda. I spoke about it in one context earlier by Shal Shudas. I want to speak about a very different context now. There's a Gemara in Shabbos, in the sugya of Hanukkah. It says that, Rav Huna says, that Hazoyer b'ner, if a person is careful in the mitzvahs of ner, Havon le b'nin tamir chachamim. He's zoyer to have children or tamir chachamim. Now, the word ner doesn't, there are some Rishonim that have a gears of ner Hanukkah. Most of them don't. So Rashi says it includes both. It includes the Ner of Shabbos and Ner of Hanukkah. Shal Shudas spoke about the common denominator of the two. Now I'd like to speak about the complementary nature of it. It seems as if the two together, in other words, neither one in its own is sufficient of a schus to have children Tamir Chachamim. It's just the two together. And that's why it's sort of generic. Hazor b'ner, if you're a rogel b'ner, if you're careful, if you're used to having ner, both ner Hanukkah and ner Shabbos together, those two items complement each other, and you have children tamir chachamim. It's obviously not terribly expensive. It's not sort of mesiris nefesh that you're doing it, but there's something about the nature of each mitzvah that contributes to having children Tamir Chachamim. And I'd like to explore for a few minutes the complementary nature, because in a large sense, it reflects the complementary elements of Talmud Torah itself, being a Talmud Chacham. First, I'd like to point out a stark contrast between the two. Ner Shabbos, if you don't use it, you are. If you don't use it, is a bracha batala. You have to use Ner Shabbos. You have to. That's one of the issues when people go away and if they want to light at home, they have to stick around for a while to be able to make some use of it. Ner Hanukkah, you're not allowed to use. That's a pretty polar. A mitzvah as you can get in that sense. Ner Shabbos is specifically inside the house. Ner Hanukkah is specifically outside of the house. Even if we light it inside, it's meant to light out. Ner Hanukkah, Ner Shabbos, is for the Bnei Bayis. It says that it's Shalom Bayis, because Bnei Bayis are very edgy. If it's dark, then people bump against each other and so on. It's for Bnei Bayis. Ner Hanukkah, ideally, you're supposed to see it by somebody else. Somebody else is supposed to see it by you. And there's something called Brichas Ariya. If you didn't light your house, if you're homeless, you don't have a house, you make a brach on seeing it by somebody else, not your Rishus. So two, three elements that are really, really very, very distinct. Not only distinct, but opposite. So these are both iris, these are both lights, and yet they're so different in what we're supposed to take from it. There's Gemara Pesachim. the Gemara is dealing with a pasuk in Tehillim. It says, "Halu kol koich ve'oyer," that all the stars of light should praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The sugi over there is really concerned with the usage, the syntax of the word or, whether it means the time of light, the verb to light up, and so on. That's really the concern of the Gemara there. But the Gemara deals with this pasuk, and the Gemara says, koich ve'or hu debod halu, koich ve'm she'ene me'ir leibol halu, stars that light up the heavens, that give light, only they are supposed to praise God. What about stars that don't light? So the Gemara says it means something else. It can't mean that. But the Pashto Pshat is, in other words, those stars who give light. What does that mean? So some of the commentators, I think the Mitzuda says that the planets, which are much closer, much, much brighter, give some light that's to some degree usable here. So that Venus is a very bright star. You could, you know, it's sort of like a very faint moonlight. You can make use of it. And then there's Kochavim, the other stars that we discern as sort of a bright point, but they don't shine down here, are called Koichim Shainim Iriam. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu created two sets of light. Kochav that's Meir and Kochav that's Eino Meir. The stars that cast light, the stars that don't cast light. What's the point of having the stars that give light? So in some way they're contributing, I don't know if even if it's minor, but at least what's the point of having two sets, and it's marked enough that the pasuk refers to it? There's koch ve'or and there's koch ve'dar nar or. What's the point? It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a bria. Every aspect of it has meaning to us. So let's explore a little bit the following point. Light is allied and identified with understanding. In other words, if I have a chair over here and it's dark in the room, then as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't exist. I don't see it. I can't describe it. I have no contact with it. I could bump into it, but that would also be kind of a form of sensing it. Light is my mind's tool for grasping something. What the hand does with grasping, my line of sight does for understanding. So when colloquially, that's the expression we use. Oh, I see. It means I have it. I understand it. It's sight is sort of the hand of my mind, in a sense, if you wish, that is giving me a handle on it. And that's why light refers to chachma. Again, colloquially, we speak about an enlightened person versus a benighted person. Or is something that is chachma, Torah, and so on. And that's the light. That's where we use that description, that metaphor for chachma. There's now a person who approaches Torah. There are religions that approach their religion with a sense of total lack of understanding, whether it's some forms of Christianity, Islam to a large degree. Again, I'm not the person who can speak on their behalf, but the bit that I've been able to gather, there's no Torah to sit and to study it, because understanding it seems to detract from it. It's as if how dare you think you can understand God's work or whatever it is, and just stand back in awe, reverence, and so on. That's one area. So almost all religions have an element of prayer to it, an element of worship, but Talmud Torah, the way we have it, is pretty unique. the level of involvement that our mind has in studying and being done and mefalpol and omidan halacha and paskin halacha and understanding the depth of it and plumbing the depth of it is very unique. On the other hand, secularists in the big tent of psych, in other words, any person not taking God into the cheshbon starts with the axiom that anything that my mind can't understand is out of my realm of connection. A, down deep he believes it doesn't exist, and since logically you can't make that statement, you say, okay, it's irrelevant. But my realm of morality and my realm of what it is that I owe any sense to is only that which I can understand. I understand it, I fathom it, it makes sense, it measures up to common human sensitivity, and that's what goes. A Talmud Chacham is really, in a certain sense, an almost a paradox. He needs to understand and yet know that the road is infinite, and he's never, ever understanding it till the end of it. If he would, then it wouldn't be God's Torah. Anything that I can understand, then me and God are the same. And the word God is just a meaningless word. If I'm as smart as God, then God is pretty stupid. I didn't say it that way, but I don't have anything. On the other hand, if I don't understand anything, and I don't try to understand anything, I have no connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because understanding is the firmest part of my person. And if I can't grasp something and it be firm in my mind, then it's a one-way street. There's no chibur, there's no connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave two types of ha'oris in the world, two types of or. There's koychavim that are me'irim and koychavim she'ne me'irim. There's a type HaKadosh Baruch Hu, some of the light comes down to us and we can integrate it in our senses, and some of it just stands up there so that we look up and say, you know, there's light up there, but I can't grab hold of it. It's beyond me. Understanding that there's something beyond you is as enlightening as understanding that which is within your grasp, within your reach. Those are the two types of kerchavim, the kerch ve'oyer, and the kerch ve'meir, and the kerch ve'enemir. That's the pshat in the Gemara. Harugel b'ner, you need to, if you want children talmidei chachamim, if you want to produce talmidei chachamim, you need to send a dual message. One is, if you work hard enough and you're omel enough, there is an awful lot that you can understand and will understand and need to understand. And the second message is, no matter how much you understand, it is beyond you. The statement, I don't understand it, is far, far from being synonymous with, and therefore it's wrong or doesn't exist. It's beyond me. That's a good statement. A person should be very honest. The person should say, I don't understand. That statement is a very important statement. It says, Lamad l'shayn chalei meni yadea. But the conclusion, and therefore it is wrong, doesn't exist, or whatever, is a false, because it presupposes that I grasp all the light. Harugel b'ner, a person who's used to lighting both candles in his house, the Shabbos and Hanukkah. The Shabbos candle is the one that we need to use, must make use. It's part of the fabric of the family. It's our light. And the Hanukkah, which we can't use, we see it outside, far away, by somebody else. We see it always in the distance. We see it always as beyond. Those are the two narratives together that produces children Talmidei Chachamim. And for us especially, we're all people, whether even for those of us in yeshiva full-time, we're in a world that there's been tremendous advances in science and understanding and ideas, and it's wonderful. On the other hand, becoming enlightened in a Torah way means that you never lose sight. That for every star you see, there are many you can't draw on the light. And keeping both in mind together makes a person really enlightened. The expression we use in Chanukah is a lichtige Chanukah. It should be a Chanukah full of light, and especially this type of light, where we're able to see that there's a big, big world beyond us. And as we grow higher, some of those stars become accessible. If we become taller, some of those stars are mayor also. But there's plenty and plenty of stars that we need to grow to, rather than just at first hand that make be able to use them. Any questions? What would you like? What? Okay, sure. You're Benji? I'm not seeing. Okay, good. It's hot, yeah. I don't have the light. There's no kochma or over here.
Okay, so, how would one define sinna and ava, and whether they necessarily have to be opposite from each other?
Give me a little more concrete.
Yaakov, he says, the brothers hated Yaakov.
Yosef, you mean?
Yosef, excuse me. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And also, we have the mitzvah of Avos Hashem.
Well, sinner doesn't always have to come. I mean, the real truth is probably the opposite of ava would be something more like apathy. Sinner, a lot of times, it's somebody you could like. I hate to be so blunt, very rarely they get hatred and bitterness like a married couple that's splitting up. And it has a lot to do with the fact that there was a very strong bond and something cut it, overrode it. A person in the street or somebody that you have some negligible kesha with, you don't have those type of very powerful feelings because the person never interacted with you. So usually the strongest sin is reserved for somebody you're close to. So it's sort of different. Sin is, I feel threatened by the person, angered, not uninterested. Ava implies two avenues. A, I enjoy the person, and B, I see myself aligned with the person. Somebody once, a Baal Teshuva, very, very man of the world, he was editor, he was of many, very important magazines actually, many years ago, I was schmoozing with him in the old city, and he told me, he made an interesting observation. He said, he was speaking about the fact that, unfortunately, many times by religious people, you have, when you have, God forbid, a divorce, it's usually very, very bitter and difficult. And the world out there, it's, a lot of times it's kind of very easy. And he said, eventually observation, he said, a divorce in the Orthodox world is a tragedy. In the secular world, it's the marriage ended. When you have a car and it lasted 10 years, that's great. You don't feel bad when you drop it off as a donation for the yeshiva or something like that. It's over. And there's a certain expectation of a strength of bond that when that's hurt, it brings that. So it's not always that sinner. If you look at the parishes, the brothers have been the worst haters because there was a bond there, whether they liked it or not. So sin is not definite, loved after the opposite of av. Av includes two elements in it. What else? Yes?
I have a Mira Tennessee.
Yeah.
So I guess my question, kind of segueing off what Benji just asked, throughout Sefer Bereishit, there are a number of stories that I've personally, and through speaking to a number of rabbis and friends, found hard to understand.
Yeah.
Benji brought the case of the hate of the brothers toward Yaakov.
Right.
The case of Shechem and what Shimon and Levi did.
Right.
And the Ramban's explanation on that. And the story that we saw in this week's Parsha of Yehuda and his actions Yitzchak loving seemingly loving Esau more than Yaakov.
Right.
In fact, out of all the other, like, it seems like in terms of really picking the right path, Avram was the only one that can really see, like, all the right choices coming to him, and then you see, like, these minute problems coming up with all the with everyone after him. And so,
right.
What's the proper lens to reading through those stories and really understanding how we can connect with them and not just leave with, like, a bad impression?
Good. You're asking it in a very intelligent way, and a very very honest and very positive, which is good. Let's first take a general sense of things that we need to ask ourselves, and then, you know, with the understanding that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wrote the Torah, and taking these stories as they are, as they appear to us written. Let's take David HaMelech, for instance. That's my best example. David HaMelech is somebody that comes across bad in a lot of ways. I certainly haven't done any of the things that the Torah writes, that the Navi writes about David, but I don't even get honorable mention in the Tanakh. I mean, David, Hashem says David is my favorite. He is my beloved one. He's the one I love. He's the one that will redeem the Jewish people. And you know, at the end, now, what's in it? If I like somebody who's a crook, it may be because I'm naive. It may be because the guy has got a lot of, you know, he's cool and he knows how to win over people, even though he's evil. It might be that I need him. He's a powerful guy. He's got money or whatever it is. So I have an angle why. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what do we find so appealing about David? So the answer that we have to have, and Ezra says, and many say, would be as following. You hold people up to standards that are apropos to them. For instance, let's give an example. You ever see, like, a young kid, a brash kid, a stupid kid, he hears people talking about a professional basketball player, the guy stinks, he lousy shots, says no, and the kid says, yeah, he doesn't do that, I could beat him, you know, that type of stuff. Says to the kids, you're an idiot, you know, he's a pro, yes, he's not as good as a pro is, and he's got shortcomings, but you don't even count, you know, you're nobody. So the lens that one will look at is the Torah presents somebody as an important person. Avraham, Yitzchak, each one is a piece. Each one is an av, and they're the only one called avas. Means the building blocks. Now the question is: so, A, we need to understand the issues as being magnified, but appropriately wrong for those people. For some things that you missed by a hair's breadth, where there were two sides to the issue, and I could have decided A or B, and a very, very strong arguments both ways. And for instance, let's take an example. Let's take the brothers and Yosef, which is an extraordinary event. But let's see how the brothers looked at Yosef. Yosef was the loner. Yosef was always busy talking about them. Yosef was the one that was always making trouble. He was playing favorites. And he comes along with a dream, I'm going to be king. So it's clear he's a megalomaniac and he's out to take over. And he probably would kill them, at least the oldest ones, so that he could get whatever power. He's obviously power hungry, and so on. And there really was grounds to think like that. The reason why they were so terribly wrong was because it's like that great baseball player makes a shot, and someone gives him a tiny touch, and he's off by that millimeter because, you know, it's someone had just kind of and so because he's so fine tuned. You know, they had their own interests, and they should have been keen and said, as great as the argument is, and as much as you all think like that, there's something affecting your thinking. So it's correct to see them for being wrong, but it's like an angle. A 45 degree angle is 45 degrees, but it could be a millimeter apart, and it could be 10 miles apart. So the Torah tells us this is where you come from. These are the strong points, and these are the flaws. So Avram's chesed is built into you, and Avram's not being strong enough about Yishmael is built into you, and you'll suffer from Yishmael. Yitzchak's middles are in you, and some of his shortcomings in you. His inability to distinguish between Esau and Yaakov. Yosef and the brothers, each one of you draws from a brother, and you have some of that jealousy which plagues us this very day. So we need to look at them as the big people that were. The Torah, of all humanity, the Torah has a few dozen people that it feels fit to mention. They are very big people. Their actions are those that really have set the pace for us, that they're in our genes, and this myself is similar bunim, and yet their faults are faults, and we're still suffering, and we need to find those faults within ourselves. One of the things I always have, the problems I have when people write about certain biographies, they're not honest, they didn't write about faults and problems like that. It's true, but what I find is, if you write a biography about someone with a fault, instead of saying, well, I will emulate the good and I'll try to fix the fault, the most people's message is, nobody's good, so I might as well, I am perfect, and let's leave myself at that. People don't like to take that. So I think the right approach is to, the Torah is presenting a certain picture. Chazal also help us flesh out the background, the understandings of why it was a much closer call than you imagine. For instance, about David HaMelech, she was technically divorced. It was still wrong, but it smelled of being an Eishes Ish. But technically he was right. It gives a different perspective. It's A, technically you're right, but still you should have held up to a higher standard. Yes? I mean. Anyone else?
So I was wondering.
Can you just give me your name? I'm sorry. Turkelwitz.
Yeah,
yes, okay.
Yeah. So I was wondering, Joseph's brothers are not kids, during the parsha. So I was wondering, why they'd be so angry over a coat. I was wondering, how they could have such jealousy over. I don't understand their hatred towards Joseph.
Well, of all the things that symbolize an ongoing favoritism, it's like wearing some sort of badge or wearing... I mean, the coat was a sort of a garment of royalty. It's like giving the person leaves, five leaves or whatever it is. This was a way of stating he's royalty. That was to be head of it. So it wasn't just a coat, that it was a designer coat, and they were all an Eddie Bauer, they killed people for an Eddie Bauer coat or something like that. No, it was a designation. The point, if you keep looking, is he implied that he's king, and Yaakov Avinu fed that point. And I want to go a step further with that also. For us, we all think that we're wonderful people because we don't care about kavod and stuff like that. They were very... Each tribe had a certain perspective. Let's give an example. Chassidim and Misnagdim today get wonderfully along. We go to their concerts, they go to our concerts, we've been at their concerts, they've been at our concerts. It's all wonderful. The Av and Ach was wonderful. 200 years ago, people were killing each other, almost literally. They didn't want to kill each other, but they're getting the Tsar to kill each other. Are we so much better? How do we understand it? They were the wicked people and we're wonderful guys? And the answer is, they cared a lot. It was very meaningful to them, and they saw each other as being a terrible deviation that's going down the drain. Every person, when he sees things from a certain perspective, leadership of Klal Yisrael meant, how do you paint the picture of Klal Yisrael? Are Klal Yisrael a group of people supposed to be sitting in coal all day and a few guys going to the army and being the doctors? Is Klal Yisrael supposed to be a nation of doctors and people going to the army and a few guys sitting in a coal someplace? Is none of that? Are we supposed to be sort of farmers and that's it? Those visions were very important. And they were going to the heart of who they were. And Yosef usurping the leadership meant Klal Yisrael would have a very different spin than it's supposed to have. The arraignment of the tribes was the picture of the Jewish people. And that's what their lives was about. So without understanding their how strong they were, how principled. There's a tremendous vote from Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Yoshe Ber's father. It says that when God created man, so the different malachim weighed in, they voted. So Tzedakah said, create man, because they give Tzedakah. Emes said, don't create man, because they're liars. Chesed said, create man, because they do chesed to each other. And Shalom said, don't create man, because they're always warring. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu took Emes, threw him down on the ground, and it was 2-1 vote. It was the first rigged election, by the way. We're only here because somebody fixed an election. Remember that. So whenever you speak about fixed election, remember we're here. So he asked, I don't understand, he said. But still, it's 2-2. Even if Emes fell to the ground, it's two. What does Chazal mean? What does Chazal explain? So Soloveitchik said a tremendous vote. He said, it's not true. People can be men of peace. People can be men of truth. But both together is an almost impossibility. If you're standing on principle, then it's very hard to get along with people that are not in line with you. And if you just are jolly, good-natured, and everybody's good and everything's wonderful, then it's very hard to stand on any principle. So that tightrope between Emes and Shalom, of course, we don't care much about anything, and just leave me alone, and everything's good, and everybody's good, and that's fine. But when people were very, very adamant on principle, very stood on principle, it was a tough battle. It was, so we need to look at the other side of it, also understand that some of our niceness and getting along is because, like this, like that, the other thing. Yes?
My name is Judah Kerbal. Hope my question is formulated in a coherent enough way, but drawing on a point that you were just making and something I've been wondering for a while, and you were also talking before about how we want our children to be talmidei chachamim.
Right.
The question is what the ideal is for the average average Jew, the average Baal Bas, because on the one hand, like there's for example Hilchos Shabbos, there's a lot there's a lot to know. It's very hard to keep everything. Is every Jew supposed to keep every seif in the Mishnah Berurah related to Shabbos and to other things? And also, we live in the world needs to sort of be sustained by people who work, who make food, who do all these who are doctors and do all these services. Not everyone can be learning Torah all the time. And
so when you asked me, I didn't get to one half of the question. When you said to keep every seif in Mishnah Berurah, you meant to learn every seif in Mishnah Berurah or to keep it? Which one did you?
I'm saying like keeping.
So
it's the learning and the doing. I guess I'm wondering about the ideal for the.
So the doing, I would assume, is for everybody. I don't think there ought to be a problem. It's not more difficult for someone who has a real job and the professional to keep Hilchos Borer it's not harder for him than it is for me, and it's not easier for me than it is for him. So I would say in the world of keeping, yes, that I think should be universal. Obviously everyone has his weaknesses, that's personal, but it's as far as studying Torah goes, so my sense is like this. I think that people's level of Torah, familiarity Torah, should be at least equal to their level of psychoacademic achievement. What I mean is, just like some people couldn't care less about science really much. Just that their nature is, as long as it's a good deal, let's do the deal and we'll let somebody else do the science, I'm not interested. Some people have a hard time living in a world where they don't understand how things work. They don't feel comfortable getting into a car without trying to figure out why it works, how it works. There's a very healthy intellectual curiosity. People read ideas, people, whether it's philosophy, whether it's literature, it's painful sometimes to see someone whose religious understandings are based on high school, which we all know was a very, it was an experience, but intellectual, very few kids are turned down intellectually in high school, as college, you know, once you get into college, you get older, you get more mature, the type of lectures. So a lot of times you see somebody struggling because the religious education he was exposed to was when he was immature. The teacher was obviously trying to cater to him at that age, and that's the level that he has, whereas his secular perspective is shaped by people who are much brighter, at an age when he was much more mature and really interested. So I would think that a person, an honest perspective would be to have that same level of understanding. And each person is different. There's nothing, not everyone has to be a great Torah scholar, but I think there has to be a certain level of parity between, you know, my general sense of things and my Torah sense of things. Yeah.
My name is Nathan. And first of all, just thank you very much. It's really wonderful to
be
here.
I want to tell you, it's my pleasure with everybody. I enjoy it very much. I enjoy my Malka, I enjoy the Chevra, and I'm very glad we can do this from time to time. Yeah, so.
Anyways, I have a question that's very different from the questions that I was asked before. It's more of just a curiosity question,
sure.
I guess. So when I was in yeshiva, I went to Yeshiva Har Etzion. One of the questions that was frequently asked.
Har Etzion or Tzion?
Har Etzion.
Okay, yeah.
That
iron is a big difference.
Yes.
I've seen both, and the iron is a really big difference. Yeah.
One of the questions I was frequently asked was, if you were on an island and you were allowed only 3 svarim with you, what would they be and why?
Okay. That's it? Yeah.
I'm just curious. I'm curious.
It's hard for me to think of it that way. It's a kind of interesting. If I can tell you, I'll phrase it just a little bit differently, and sort of there's. If you're to ask me, what's my chiyus in Torah? In other words, where do I feel that sense of powerful identity? So I would say the Talmud first. In that, in the sense, there's a solidity in Talmud where and you feel more and more like this is whatever ideas I have to come back to it. So there's something about it that it's like a meal. You can nash occasionally. You can, but at the end of the day, you come back to bread, meat, and potatoes kind of thing. That's what Talmud is. For me, the other sefer that has been very, I guess, in the world of, called Machshav as a general sense, of those form, the Maral is a sefer that to me was kind of, the two other, the Rambam, as time goes on, I begin more and more to get a sense of how much was packed into every word and how much he's put things in perspective. So Rashi and the Rambam of the two Sfarim that I think are the is putting things in a very, I guess, giving you a crisp sense of understanding. I guess that would be but you know, I have in the little iPod I have everything plus. So but you know, I guess if you ask, Shas is a certain solidity that you know it. You can pass from a Gemara. You'd be wrong most of the time, but you'd have the first step right. I always have an argument with my wife because women and men are different. I tell her, if you do a math problem and you get it right till the last step, that's great. And her reply is always, what's the point if you haven't gotten the answer right? Women are practical and men are not so. But if you're passing from a Gemara, you have the first step right. You don't know the next step. And so there's some feeling about it, knowing that really gives it. I remember my father, Zohan Efracha, Zemira Shiva, if he asked you a question, halach, if he sometimes sort of gave you a riddle or a test, or someone asked you, if you started the answer with anything but the Gemara, it was a no-go. You know, if you started like what the Mishavur brings from the Shalakas, like that didn't go. if you did the Gemara, if you had the Gemara with the Taisis, with the basic, with some basic Rishonim, then he would say, okay, and you also have to take care of this sheet or something like that. But, you know, there was a certain attitude. And then the world of the Amkus, the Pnimius of Torah, for me, morale probably of all this forum was the most eye-opening, I guess. So, did you ever see, they have, if you learn Hatzion, you probably have seen it, Chaim Sabato's interview with Rav Salav, with Rav Lichtenstein. Did you see it?
Yeah.
At Vakshe Panecha, and where he asked them which is the most critical sefer in Jewish Machshava. Did you see that? It's an amazing piece. It's a stunning piece. There's a full page, a full book interview with Rav Lichtenstein from Gush. It's written by somebody, Chaim Sabato, who's an extraordinary writer himself, really extraordinary writer. He's written four books, and they're amazing. They're like sort of novels, kind of. He's true, but he's a stunning writer, and he really speaks to him about his life and so on. And he asks him, "What do you think the most important sefer in the world of Machshava is?" And he asked it to Rav Lichtenstein, and unbeknownst to him, he also asked Rav Lichtenstein's son, and they both gave the same answer. So you're expecting the Rambam. Lichtenstein said, the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim is a very chash of a sefer, but we could live without it. It's not the sefer that set the tone for understanding. Said the Ramban is the sefer that is absolutely an absolute necessity. And the truth is, if you really look at the Ramban, the Ramban has given us a sense of a certain depth in common chat. The Ramban has introduced some of the basic ideas of Kabbalah that should be in everybody's lexicon, without using the fancy words, but just the sense of it. He's given us a sense of what are the appropriate thesis to introduce. You know, and Ramban stood on a few different worlds in a way that the Rambam didn't. In Halacha, the Rambam is the sefer, and whether we pass on him or not, he's the start of it. I mean, that's the central sefer. In Machshava, the Ramban is really, really a very central sefer. I was stunned by that by that point in the interview. So,
yeah, he gave a shir, or Aaron gave a shir on Ramban al Tara once a week. It was spectacular.
Every week.
Yeah. Some episodes.
Yeah. So it's a. People. It's somebody once described very well. Ramban al Torah. He said it's like Tosfos on the Gemara. It teaches you the next. What's the right next step? In other words, Rashi gives you the pshat on the psukim. If I want to ask a kasha, what are the appropriate approaches to consider? What are the type of ideas to root in? Like Tosfos, that's what Tosfos does for us. Tosfos was the generation after Rashi. Rashi had daughters, so they weren't learning Gemara in those days. So they didn't live many Sfarim. As his grandchildren were Tosfos. That was the Bali Tosfos. It's an astounding family. And Tosfos is the next step. Okay, now I know that it says here how to learn what it says here, but I have a Gemara someplace else that says differently. How do I reconcile it? Which is the next step, and the Ramban, in a certain sense, does that in Chumash. It's much harder, it's much broader, but yes, that's what he does. Anything else?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Ilan Aiken.
Yeah.
With so many Hebrew Sfarim being published translated into English,
right?
What's the importance of like breaking our teeth over Gemara and like gaining and building our textual reading skills?
I'll tell you the truth. I find it very difficult and almost impossible to read English. There was a boy in our yeshiva many years ago. He's been at yeshiva like a dozen years. Nobody knows him. It's not even having a lashon hara. He had very severe dyslexia in Hebrew. Very amazing, extremely well written and very literate in English, and could not read Hebrew. Not at all. I mean, he would daven San Sviyama. He was quite musical. He would daven. He would struggle literally reading letter by letter. It was very painful. And he explained to me once why it is like that. He said, because since he has a phonetic sense of English, the written word comes in, this doesn't come in. That was it. So, but he read a massive amount in English. And he would constantly be asking a question, explaining and saying things and that. And it was a very painful experience for me because he was always wrong, but not in a way that I could possibly explain. Like, it was, yes, technically, it's like when Google translates the document from, like, Hebrew to English, it technically might be right, but it's certainly not what the original. You know, it just doesn't have, it's not right. And I'll tell you the truth, I've you know, sometimes I write in Hebrew and I write in English, and sometimes I rewrite it. I write the same thing, but I don't translate. I start all over again. And I was just actually looking downstairs now. I went to get a safe, and something else fell down. Somebody had translated some things of mine in English into Hebrew, and I'd never really looked at it. I looked at it and I said, "Ah, yucks." And it wasn't. It technically was right. It didn't have the flavor. Didn't have the sense of it. You know, and Torah was given in Hebrew, and Gemara was in Gemara Hebrew, Gemara Aramaic, and you lose it. You lose it the minute you translate it. So if you have no choice, it's an aid, but you're an outsider until you don't have it in the Hebrew, and that's why it's very, very important to make that step. You know, it's a wonderful. We have so many translations, but you're alien. I tell you, this boy used to come to me and say. Rav Moshe Chaim Tzadok writes the following in Derech Hashem, and I didn't know how to answer him. I would say, well, yes, but no. You know, he's writing those words, but they don't mean. Words mean so much more when. Let me give you an example. Let's take something. Let's say you ask the question, and I would tell you, okay, at some point we'll look into it. That has a certain flavor in English. Does it translate into Hebrew? In English, it means when Mashiach comes and Mitzvah Hashem, we'll have a go at it. It doesn't translate that in any other language, unless it doesn't. It doesn't have the flavor. It doesn't have the feeling. It's just you know, and that's why it's very interesting. People who become Bala Tshuva, so. All of a sudden, all sorts of things that you didn't realize were important. A guy who came from a conservative background and he knew Hebrew is so much ahead of the game than the guy who doesn't know Hebrew. And in learning Sfarim, it's like that 100%. And I would tell you to break your teeth and use English translation as an aid, but get the feeling, get the flavor in its original language. It's true about anything. If you want to do French literature, the translations in English is not the way to go. And certainly something like Chinese literature, where it's a whole different mindset, a whole different world, doesn't... Want to get him? Or? Yes?
This goes back to what the Rosh Yeshiva was talking about before, about a lot of us, I guess personally, I guess I'm speaking for a lot of us that we're trying to enter the business world and make parnasa and
right.
Try to have to work with this balance of straddling two worlds. And right now there's a lot of emphasis that they're telling us in the business school and when recruiters come in about networking and making connections and going to happy hour with the office and
right.
Knowing as many people as you can so you can bring in clients and get ahead in your career. So that's not really something that I want to do, and because I'm coming from the perspective that I'm trying to work as little as possible, and
right.
But at the same,
I think that everybody is coming out perspective. The motive for doing so might be different, but I think the working as little as possible, I think, has a certain universal appeal to it. Yes. Most people won't work as little possible as go to the happy hour. That's the, you know.
I guess, coming from the perspective that, Hashem's ultimately in charge of our parnasa.
Right.
But at the same time, we have to put in an effort and do the best we can.
Right.
But also that we want to make time to be, Kovei Eitim for learning and
right.
Raise a family and everything. So, does Rosh Yeshiva think that the social aspect and trying to, I guess, get ahead in our career, is that something that's also expected of us?
Two, two parts to your question. First of all, ultimately, it's everybody's nisayon to try to weigh into balance bitachon and ishtadlus. You know, when people give you a recipe for success, which includes giving everything of yourself away, all your time. I mean, most people in most successful people don't get married till late, don't have families, don't give much for their families. Really, you know, when they tell you a corporation wants you to be more devoted to corporation than anything else, so you have to say to yourself, you know, where's the means and where's the end to it? And you have to be realistic and say to yourself, you know, yes, this is like the, you know, 1,000 umph, you know, like, yes, if you do everything in the world, but the only thing that's important is where your career is going. But if you want to balance it, you pull back. And I think at some point, once you get a little experience, you realize what's absolutely necessary, what's quite important, what's possibly important, and what's, yeah, for the one half of 1% to want to get that very, very, you know, high rank job, that's them to do. You're going to need to use your judgment for that. The second part, the social part, I think that's a very important nekuda. I was reading actually a biography of the Reichmans. I don't know if people know today who Reichmans were. Reichman brothers were a family of four brothers in Canada, Haredi, who were billionaires, multi-billionaires, before it was fashionable to be a billionaire. I mean, they were, and they used to support the vast majority of Haredi institutions. They misinvested on Canary Wharf in England, and they basically lost them. I mean, they were still wealthy, but not what they were, and that's it. They were Toronto. And somebody wrote a book about them, and it was a tremendous Kiddush Hashem that somebody writing a book about them after they crashed couldn't find anything really wrong. In other words, it crashed for business reasons. You know, it was overextended in something which should have been good, but a combination of factors and so forth. But one of the points he makes there is, he says, they never, ever included their personal life and their business life were two worlds. Nobody was invited to their bar mitzvahs, chasanas. Most people didn't know if they had families. They just, there was nothing. There was a lot of interaction, business, always very cordial and friendly and nice. You know, I always say that people have the wrong attitude. The crass attitude is, I'm going to be a little more coarse than I should be, but I just want to get the coarse person says, cheat the goyim, but drink with them. Like, you know, money is money, so that's when you all of a sudden become like, oh, they're only goyim. But, you know, like, what's wrong? Like, you know, like, I'll go to the bar with them and you know, I'll be part of their world and everything else. The Torah's view is the exact opposite. You have to treat with honesty, with civility, with menschlichkeit, kindness. Those are very, very positive virtues to everybody. But social life, in the sense of more than just a formality, but forming bonds that go beyond business interaction, civil interaction, is reserved for Klal Yisrael. And it's important. So yes, of course, business requires a certain level of interaction like that. But for many people, the social life in the business world is replacing their own empty. They don't have family lives. They don't have a shul. They don't have people to go to shir with. Where does a typical a secular person or non-frum person have a chevra? There's no chevra shas. There's no dafayomi shir. There's no Shabbos davening. There's no kiddush. There's no yeshiva. So it's the office, it's the business, it's the clients. That's their social life. Baruch Hashem, it's not ours. We have a world of family people. And it's one of the things we need to thank Rosh Baruch for, that we have a world, we have a life. So one should stay away. And again, you know, if it's a need in a business, and it's a normal need, then fine. But you need to make those demarcations for yourself as you go along. I mean, I'm an outsider. It's not my world. I can't tell you crack, but I just sort of sketch out the guidelines. Yes?
So this question, I don't mean it in a disparaging way. I mean it in an honest way.
Sure.
One of the things that I personally have struggled to understand is you know, I'm coming from a camp of appreciation of Torah, I can connect to that, how that makes a person spiritual, how that develops their relationship with Hashem.
Mm.
But one of the things that I've noticed...
Eden, you mind opening the window a little bit? It's a little stuffy here. You can open the door a little bit. Just, yeah. What was I saying? One of the things what?
Sure. One of the things that I've noticed in being involved in a secular environment, like at the University of Maryland, or growing up in the community, like Silver Spring, and, you know, being aware that there are non-Jewish people or less
right.
Jewish people, is that, all, you know, you have these people that can find a spiritual sense of appreciation for life, and, you know, and some people will want to go travel around the world, and they'll say, oh, I connect to God, whatever that means to them, because I see all the beautiful things He created.
Right.
And I don't see sitting and learning Torah as my, they say, like, you'll hear people say, that's not my way of connecting. I connect to God because I see the beautiful things He created, or I connect to God because I feel a sense of spirituality and doing, you know, beautiful kindness and caring acts for people.
Right.
But there's no place for Torah for me in that lifestyle, but I'll have a fulfilling sense of life by traveling the world and seeing these beautiful creations, doing things that connect me to the community around me and helping out and giving food to poor people.
Right.
There's plenty of examples that, you know, the more you interact with the world that's not involved in Torah, you'll see these
right.
other... And I guess my question is, how, as a Jewish person who is trying to really affirm his sense of Torah is a value and we need that, and these are other things that we do see as values, that really seeing that balance when you see other people in the world that really do feel, seem to have a beautiful life, pleasant life, happy life, and, you know, you see plenty of people who live a Torah-based lifestyle that struggle very deeply financially to have a good livelihood, etc. I'm not trying to ramble, but hopefully my question is somewhere clear in all that, that where you, how can you, I guess, find a sense of, find that sense that Torah has to be the center of life, and yet see all these people around the whole world that somehow have this spiritual experience in doing
right.
these things?
Well, the difference is, let's take an example. You have a businessman who's born, he was born in Hungary before the war, was in concentration camps, came to America, started a small, I don't know, mom and pop shop, and today he's a big real estate mogul, and he says, you know, I always have a sense of where to invest the money and which guys are worth investing money, which guy not. Is there any point to going to business school? And I know guys went to business school and they're basically doing nothing and this and that. And if you think about it, you come up with the following point. The people have intuitive business senses. And people who don't have that sense, they can have a PhD in business. All they can do is teach in business school, but they can't make any money. But there is an advantage. The person who understands the system has an understanding that the other person only has a feel for. Now, the arousal we have when you see something extraordinary, when you touch with somebody, those are real things. But if Torah is given, is explained, but where does it come from? It sort of, God trails off in a sort of vague, meaningless, you know, it's like the guy with intuition. You know, this business is a no good business. Why? Because I just feel it's no good. You feel that if the intuition could be quantified, if he could understand it with the models a professional has, he would have the best of both worlds. Torah is giving you a sketch. There's a Bria, there's a Bor Olam. Every person has Neshama, and the Neshama is that which pushes in a certain direction, arouses certain feelings. There are dimensions to Neshama. Chesed is one dimension, Torah is another dimension, Tefillah is another dimension, Kedusha is another dimension. You, by having Torah, have a picture of it. Now you need to use your sense of religiosity and fill in that picture and to give it life and to live it. He has a strong intuition, but if he's not going to ever see it written up inside, it's going to be vague, and that's it, like the person with intuition. And one day when that guy's business comes crashing down, he can't understand why it came crashing down. I don't know. I was sure it was a good business. I don't know why it failed. I can't figure out. The world is not what it used to be. You know, that's the type of thing you'd get. And we look at it in the kind of blind, like we spoke about being enlightened. I guess that would be an accurate analogy between the things you've described. Thing? Or what? Yes? Yeah? A couple of things. There's more food also, so not only more than a good in here can...